Welcome to the Tradies in Business podcast with your hosts, Warwick Bidwell and Nicole Cox. Divert your phone and grab a brew as Waz and Nick unpack tips, tales, secrets and stuff-ups from guests both inside and outside your trade, helping educate and inspire you to break the cycle of gut-busting and money stress and create a true trade business.
Hello, listeners.
Howdy.
How are we doing today?
Well, I'm well. How are you, listener?
You're well, so it doesn't matter what anybody else is feeling, eh?
Not at all.
Except for, I'm going to get in trouble for mentioning this, but you've got a dressing on your
head. Oh, thanks for telling everyone. I do. Great big white thing on my nose.
It looks like you headbutted the builder.
It does. I might have gotten a bit cross.
What's that called? The in the UK, what do they call that?
Builder
Manchester age. Kiss or something?
Yes.
I'd try and say that with an accent, and it's probably, I didn't mean to do that, but today's guest has a bit of an accent.
Segue. I like it. Well done.
He is from, I think he said he's from the Midlands around Birmingham or somewhere.
What's the source?
Worcestershire?
Yes. From
Except
near
he
there.
Said it, he said it different.
Maybe Worcester. It wasn't the same.
Worcester?
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, today's podcast guest is a bit of a legend, actually, and I've been looking forward to this interview. I've been looking forward to being able to speak properly. I've been looking forward to this real treaty. Oh, okay.
Did you do
if
that
If I was
purpose?
Smart, I would just stop recording and edit all that, but I'm going to leave it there for everybody's entertainment.
Oh, we're all human.
Coxie, take over, please.
No, you got it. You're nailing it. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to let you finish this out because you've got it.
You're going to make me do it.
I am.
Spoken like a true mother of teenage kids. All right, so today's guest, James Hill, legend, doing some amazing stuff in the mental health space. We talk a bit about suicide prevention here on the show.
We do.
And Coxie and I have both done a fair bit of work in that area in our own respective fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But today's episode is more about mental health and just the day-to-day normal challenges that a lot of us face with mental health, quote unquote. So, James is a speaker for Beyond Blue. He's a mental health first aid instructor.
I love that.
Yeah, that's kind of cool, isn't it? Mental
it's
health
really
first aid.
Cool.
Come here, Waz. I'll stick a band-aid on your noggin, mate. You'll be right. he's a suicide safe talk instructor, and he's a mental health advocate for Energy Queensland, where he actually works. And that's his role. That's his job.
It's amazing to think that there are corporations out there beginning to think about who's working for them. They're thinking forwardly rather than
and the
reactively.
Welfare of those people.
Exactly. Thank and you. That's the word I was looking for.
You're welcome. I got my mouth back. and Energy Queensland has, he does mention in the episode, but it's thousands of employees.
Mm.
So great to see that they're actually investing money in taking care of their workers. And so James obviously shares his own mental illness experience in this episode. And he's super passionate about, I guess, raising awareness, but also destigmatizing mental illness. So we're pretty fortunate to chat to James. He actually recently won an award. So he actually won the Jeff Cheverton Individual Award for his work in mental health.
It's quite amazing, isn't it?
Recognized throughout Queensland, and that was in Mental Health Week, which was recently as well. If you're listening to this episode in real time. So, James is a POM, but he's an Aussie now because he's got his citizenship.
He is an Aussie. He was a POM, now he's an Aussie.
He picks heavy things up and puts them down again like me. He does a bit of art and he's just an all-round really nice guy, actually.
Lovely man.
He's a really cool guy. So, enjoy this one with James Hill, our Real Tradie Guys episode for this week. So, we're joined today by the mildly famous James Hill for our Real Tradie Guys. Welcome to the podcast, James.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Only mildly famous? How do we determine somebody's fame?
Well, I think if you haven't got like an Oscar or a Grammy or something, you're probably not truly famous.
Oh, okay.
So the rest of us are just
mildly
famous. Yeah, it's like I was in the car park last night with my wife. We grabbed a few things at the grocery store. And I was reversing the car into a space and I said, "Oop, better make sure I don't run over the pregnant woman." And as she walked past, I said, "Actually, she's very pregnant. But I don't know that there's really a scale. Like, you're either pregnant or you're not. It's not like you're only mildly pregnant or mildly famous. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'll stop talking shit.
I always get wary about saying stuff like, just in case someone's not pregnant.
Yes.
No, she was beyond all shadow of a doubt very pregnant. But you're not pregnant, James. So, mate, welcome to a Real Tradie Guys episode. You're obviously a tradie, or you have been in your lifetime, mate. Now, we read your bio out, but they're usually pretty sanitised. So give us the real backstory to Mr. James Hill.
Yeah, okay. Well, as you say, yeah, tradie. So, look, I left school at the age of 15 to start my apprenticeship. I suppose school and academia wasn't really for me. But yeah, so that was quite a number of years ago now. But yeah, I went into the Sparky is my trade. So I sort of brought up in that industry for the last 25 years. I've been in and around that. So yeah, that's pretty much where I cut my teeth and grew up basically in that trade.
And you obviously did that in Brisbane, mate, based on your accent.
Yeah, just a little bit further north. Yeah, now look, from England, obviously. But yeah, so I was in a place called Worcester in the Midlands near Birmingham. And yeah, look, I pretty much spent all those years on construction sites. And that was, you know, when we sort of lead into, I suppose, a little bit of my journey of where I'm at now, that was probably one of the key things of I suppose what shaped me was that whole upbringing in that tough industry.
And what prompted the move to Australia, mate?
We had a couple of kids there. They were 1 and 3 when we moved. But I just kind of looked at, I wanted to give them a bit more of a lifestyle where they could be at, you know, near the beach is ideal, you know, because you'd save, spend a whole bunch of time waiting to get a holiday once every 2 years. And figured there's got to be more to life than this. So we just thought, well, let's give it a try. And if it doesn't work out, well, we'll just come back.
Must have been a big, daunting move. When I stopped to think about moving my entire family across such a long distance, I get quite nervous. Was it really hard for you? And then how did that translate to your work and what you do and how different it was from one country to another?
Yeah, look, now I think back now, I'm like, holy heck, how did I do that? But because I was running my own business over there, contracting, electrical contracting, so I was doing all right, you know, I was earning, you know, reasonable money and I was pretty busy. And then, yeah, just to jump on a plane, come here, no job, no house, no nothing, and just go, well, see what happens. Yeah, now I look back, I go, geez, I don't know if I can do that again. But, I suppose I was a bit younger back then, you know, it was like 13 years ago. So, But yeah, it was pretty daunting. I mean, work-wise, you know, electricity is the same voltage, it's the same stuff. It sort of transferred across. And if anything, probably, I don't know, a little bit more forward in a lot of the stuff over there in sort of Europe than when I got here, because I was like, oh, geez, you only just got these things in and, you know, I've been using them since I was an apprentice. So.
What are you saying? Australians are a bit backward, James.
Just a little slow.
Well, I'm not saying that. I'm not insinuating that, but I'm not saying.
Have you got your citizenship yet, mate? Because
I'm an Australian, so I'm quite happy with that.
Okay, we can tie you with the same brush.
We can.
Yeah. So, mates, I'm sort of going to jump ahead a little here. You recently won an award for your work in a particular area, and it's not electrical. Did you ever win any awards for your electrical work, mate?
No, I certainly didn't.
You weren't an award-winning electrician, but you're certainly doing some amazing stuff in the mental health space. Tell our listeners a bit more about that, James.
Yeah, so yeah, I recently won the Jeff Sheverton Individual Award at the Queensland Awards Week for, you know, the Mental Health Commission Open Minds Awards Week. So that was for individual contribution to mental health, so the stuff that I kind of do on a day-to-day basis and, you know, insider work and outsider work. Mm. And we're also fortunate enough, so I work for Energy Queensland, to win the Large Workplace Award as well, and that's based on the work that myself and a colleague of mine, Aaron, do in our role at Energy Queensland, basically.
Well, well done, mate. That's a fantastic recognition of the work that you do. And you and I actually were in the same course a couple of years ago now, I think, doing some suicide intervention training. But, mate, for our listeners' benefit, what the heck is it that you do in that mental health space, you know? And what is it that you think, I guess, contributed to you getting that recognition, both for you and your workplace?
Yeah, so I suppose when I try and define what I do, geez, I struggle myself sometimes. But look, a couple of years ago, so we can probably jump back in a little while just to understand how I got to the point that I got to. But as far as my job goes, a couple of years ago, we were fortunate enough that the CEO listened to what we had to say, myself and Aaron, about doing things differently, I suppose, with regards to mental health in the workplace. And they created a role for us as mental health advocate. So for a number of years prior to that, we were sort of looking at how things were dealt with in workplaces. And I'm not saying we were doing things badly, but we just thought maybe we could do things differently from a lived experience perspective. Just trainers out on the ground, sharing a story and looking at how to help people, how to help the business change the way we do things. So look, my job day to day, as I say, is mental health advocate. So pretty much travel all around. So we've got 7,500 staff across the state of Queensland, and travel around just delivering education, training, putting together like strategies, plans for how we actually deal with education around mental health, mental illness. And yeah, basically just having good conversations, you know, from a lived experience perspective, from a trade perspective, and just understanding what the challenges are and what we can do differently. And then, yeah, outside of work, I work for Beyond Blue as a speaker. I've done that for a number of years now. And again, that is just to try and raise some awareness and education around mental illness. And particularly, you know, it's close to my heart with guys, traders, just from my own experience, you know, that was probably my biggest undoing. And I really want to use what I've been through to try and help others.
Mm. So you mentioned what you've been through, James. Is it too much to ask to unpack that a little bit again, just so people understand, I suppose, how you've arrived at this point?
Absolutely. Yeah. Look, I'm happy to talk about it. So I suppose I'll have to go back a little while just to give you a bit of context, so you can understand me as a person and how my mind was set. So like as a youngster growing up, for those early years of my life, probably the first 10, 11 years of my life, didn't really have a father around as a permanent figure in my life. So my grandfather was the only sort of real static sort of male role model. Now, his generation obviously went through the war, very tough. So when I look at him, that's what a man's supposed to be, you know, not too much emotion out of him.
Mm-hmm.
Never ever in my life saw him cry.
Mm.
You know, I've always seen him get angry, always happy, get lucky, joking around. So I thought, well, this is what a man is. That was ingrained in me. And then, of course, you know, you watch the TV, all your heroes are just saving the day. You never see them sad or upset. Yeah. So that's kind of, you know, that was ingrained in me without knowing that that's what a man was. And then, as I said earlier on, I left school, you know, I was still a teenage, you know, youngish sort of boy when I left school, still 15 years old. And straight out into a trade, and you know, they're all older guys, you know, the guys that sort of brought me up through my electrical apprenticeship, a lot of them were sort of in their, you know, 50s now, and I look at that and I go, now it's not old because I'm nearly there, but you know, it's like, yeah, they were all guys, but you know, they were again with that tougher generation, so I never saw anybody, everyone was always joking around, or you know, the only two emotions I saw was joking and anger when people get wound up, and
that
was
it. Yeah, yep.
So that was pretty much what shaped me to understand. And I knew nothing about mental illness, not one single thing. My understanding of it was it didn't happen to people like me. It happened to people with real problems, real issues, you know, and that was it. So I was very ignorant to it. But now I look back, you know, I've pretty much had mental illness pretty much all my life. I used to suffer really badly with anxiety. Didn't know it was anxiety. You know, I used to just avoid situations and now I look back, I used to see how I used to avoid things when I used to get social anxiety pretty bad. So I used to make sure I drank heaps before I went out. That used to help. I used to get all the tightening in my chest, and I used to think that was indigestion. So I used to smash down those antacid tablets like they were lollies. Didn't fix it, you know. And looking back, that was, you know, it was pretty bad anxiety. Now, when I moved to Australia, I secured a job with Energex, working on the electricity distribution. I was doing all right, you know, on the surface. You're looking, live by the beach, you know, a wife, two kids, good job. Career moved on, you know, I worked my way up the ladder a bit to like a supervisor. So I was looking after a few traders. But then things started to unravel behind the scenes. But I didn't understand it. You know, I didn't know that I was going through depression now. And you know, as things have moved on, I understand I have like a mood disorder, you know, where I do have highs and lows and things like that. So
yep.
The time, you know, I look back and I see all the signs and the symptoms now, very easy to notice. But when you're living it and when you don't understand it, you don't know.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it started off, you know, gradually. It might have been not sleeping for a while, or I'd rerun the day 100 times through my head, catastrophizing it. You know, like I forgot to do something in the morning and I think, oh, well, they'll think this of me. And if, then they'll tell them, and then they'll tell my boss, and I'll lose my job, and then I'll lose my house, my wife, my kid. Every scenario goes back to the worst case scenario. And so it started with that. The sleep was sort of getting affected, and lower sort of moods. I used to go to the gym. Well, I still do go to the gym every day and train. But I noticed that I was struggling, you know, at the gym. The weights felt really heavy. I get, you know, we do a lot of workouts. I do CrossFit training. So, you know, there's a lot of competition environment. And that used to get in my head. So I'd find some days I'd walk to the gym and just couldn't even walk through the door. And I couldn't go in. Things were spiraling pretty badly. But on the surface, nobody would have known.
No.
You know, I kept that happy face, you know, and that was it. Or I might, the two emotions I knew were happy or angry. And that was all I knew. So I was either in a bad mood or I was joking around, but never any emotions. You know, and this went on for months and months, getting worse and worse. I started drinking a fair bit more just to try and, I suppose, numb that whole feeling of worthlessness, I suppose. And the fatigue was creeping in. You know, I'd go to work. A few hours later, I'd have to go drive down the road and have a sleep, because I just couldn't physically stay awake. It got to a point where it felt like I was living my life like looking through a window. I could see it going on around me, but I just had no energy to even do anything. And but subconsciously in my head, I'm thinking you're having some kind of breakdown or something, but then I'm going, well, that doesn't happen to people like me. You know, that's not me. And I suppose that's where it led to, you know, the point where I was contemplating suicide. You know, that was the only option I could see on the table. The world would be better without me, you know. The work would be better without me, because they'd have a boss who was better than me. My wife would find a better husband, you know, who could provide better or do better. The kids would have a better day. All these things were in my head, and I believed it, truly believed it.
Yeah.
And look, you can believe in higher powers, whatever you want, but I think sometimes things happen for a reason. And for me, that was when Beyond Blue came into my life, because I was at that moment of rock bottom. I'm thinking about my plan. I was sitting down on some rocks near the beach, and for some reason, I just put my phone on. And you know when those adverts come up, and I get them now, I might think about buying something at an advert. Go, how do they know?
Yeah.
They're listening right now, mate.
I'm glad somebody was on the same wavelength. But anyway, I put my phone in, this advert came from Beyond Blue, and it was kind of like a take the test, like a man therapy sort of thing they had, a campaign they were running for blood. And it was around depression, depression and anxiety. And I thought to myself, it just came up, you know, when I was at that point thinking about my plan, and I went, right, this isn't what's happening, but just to shut you up, basically shut myself up, I'm going to answer these questions honestly, because then that's out of the picture, and then I can carry. So I did. I answered them honestly. And you get a result straight away, straight back. and it pretty much said, you know, you need to see medical help, you know, pretty soon, straight away. You know, so now I've got two options on the table. So I sort of thought about it for a couple of days. You know, I didn't just go, oh, okay, well, I'll go to the doctor, because what do you say? Well, walking the doctor, I look at myself. There's nothing wrong with me. When I look in the mirror, I look healthy. So I don't want to waste the doctor's time. So I did sit on it for a couple of days, but I was that numb inside. I just found myself, you know, sitting in the doctor's surgery, and I'm like, okay, I'm here now. I could have walked out so many times when I was in there if I'd have had the energy. Just looking around, you know, there's real sick people in there, people with real problems, not me, as so I thought. But look, that was the start of my recovery journey. I'm thankful for it, because as soon as I walked in that doctor's surgery, I was in the office there and I said, look, I don't really know why I'm here. I did this test thing, and this is what it said. I need to see you. And he was so supportive. He said, look, yeah, I understand this is what's going on. You know, you're not the first one through the door. You probably won't be the last, but there is hope, you know. And that was the start then of me on my recovery journey. Now, I suppose what inspired me to do what I do at work came from that, because the doctor said, look, you probably don't need to be at work. That's not helping, you know, your situation at the moment. You probably need a break from that while we work on getting you right. So he gave me a sick note, you know, a doctor's cert.
Yep.
Now, as you will probably know, if you get that, it doesn't really say why you're off. It just says James is unfit for work from X date to Y date.
Yep.
So I went into work to give him a sick note to say I wasn't going to be in, but I didn't tell him exactly why. So I made up a story that there was something physically wrong with me, because I felt a lot more comfortable saying that than the real reason. Yeah. And that, once I was sort of in a better headspace, you know, the following year, then I looked back on that and went, well, why is that so? Why should I have to be ashamed of having an illness that, you know, it's just an illness? And how come I'm more comfortable making something up than doing that? And that was sort of what inspired me then to try and make that change. But that was, that's sort of, I suppose, in a nutshell, my story of how I got into the world of mental health. Because I look back at, I started working for Beyond Blue from that, because I feel like I owe that organization my life. Because I don't know what would have happened if I hadn't have come across that when I did. And I look at, I don't want to see anybody else sitting on them rocks. So if I can do as much as I can to help educate people, share some awareness, and break that stigma around all this stuff, you know, we're not going to stop people getting ill, but we're going to increase the awareness so people understand what it is, where they can go for help, what help's available out there, pathways to help, because it's a journey. You know, you don't just get better and that's it. You know, I still have issues, you know, now regularly, you know, but I know how to recognize it and what to do with it. So that's why it kind of inspires me to do what I do. I started study as well. So, yeah, took a degree in psychology, because I figured maybe I could fix myself.
Once a trainee, always a trainee.
I'll fix it myself. Exactly right. Bit of home psychology,
I've since switched actually to counselling. It's a lot more practical for me, more hands-on, let's say, from a trade perspective, you know, but you actually give you the skills to actually have conversations and help support people better.
James, I'm really interested, and I think it's an important question for our listeners to hear the answer to. Did you ever share any of what you were going through with your wife?
Not really. So, you know, it's kind of, and that comes down to that male sort of ego sort of thing. You know, I've been with my wife for a very long time. We've been together since we were teenagers, you know, so she knows me inside and out. I didn't want to be seen as, you know, I'm the fixer. You know, if something's broken in the house, I'll fix it. You know, the kids break, I'll fix it. If there's something wrong with a car, yep, I can fix it. Yeah, that's what I do as a bloke. That's what I saw my role as. So for me to actually admit that I was broken would be a failure for me. So I kept it, you know, pretty well hidden from her. I mean, I suppose what she did see was the moods, you know, the sadness or the anger when I used to get wound up. When I used to sort of drink, I'd sort of write myself off on a weekend and stuff, but not when everyone was around, you know. I'd sort of have a few drinks when people were in bed. You know, then I'd knock the top off the bourbon or whatever and just sit and put that away. But yeah, again, it comes down to that pride and that sense of shame, I suppose. It comes with it. That's ingrained in me.
I've got to be honest, that's the exact answer I was looking for, because I know, you know, just talking to tradie wives, to tradies themselves, I know that they're not sharing that part of their journey. They are afraid. There's too much stigma. And we've got lots of wives that we're talking to regularly who are telling us they're seeing those kinds of signs and they don't understand them. And I guess I just wanted to voice that so that, you know, that gives a bit of awareness that maybe our husbands or our partners are struggling and we need to help them find some help. So that was really the answer I was looking for. The other thing I wanted to unpack a little bit with you, if I could, is what anxiety felt like or looked like for you, because I think, again, like you voiced earlier, there's a lot of men and women who don't actually understand that what they're feeling is anxiety.
Yeah, so like, I mean, obviously there's the psychological side of things, so the thoughts, you know, the generalizing and the catastrophizing of things, you know, if I do this, then that, then this. So that's something to keep an eye on is the thought side of it, I suppose, is watch where your thoughts are taking you. Was it based on fact or is it based on just, because that's what the brain does. It goes worst case scenario as a protective factor, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just the whole, what I used to get is a lot of, like I say, social anxiety. So I've worked very hard on that, even as recently as, you know, in the last 12 months, to actually be able to go out and sit down in a restaurant or somewhere, have some food on my own, because I travel a lot with work now. I have to do that. But, you know, the part that I couldn't, as crazy as it sounds, but just walk into somewhere and order a coffee, because I feel like, I don't know, if I'll get something wrong, then I'll get judged, you know. And it always comes down to is that people are judging me, and you don't want to be seen as anything less than perfect.
Yes.
It's so ridiculously common. I mean, Coxie and I talk to so many tradies, and we are fortunate to work with a small handful of them, I guess. And particularly the guys, there's all this bravado, and like you, James, you know, you lift weights, you got tattoos, you know, from an outward appearance, there's all these together men, you know. Yes. They're tough and they're strong and they're confident and all this sort of stuff, you know. They're builders or sparkies or even accountants, like it doesn't really matter what the profession is. But when you scratch just a little bit below the surface, so many of us men have been so worried about what everybody thinks about us for so long, and it's so bloody ridiculous. And yet it's real. It's a real thing. I had, you know, similar stuff as a young bloke right through even till now. You know, I'm in my 40s, and while it's a lot better than it was before, and I've, you know, done a lot of work to manage it and I guess accept it, I still have that little twinge sometimes when I'm out in social settings. And I posted recently about networking.
Yeah.
You know, I was at a networking event. James is shaking his head for the listeners that
aren't
watching the video version of this. But there was 200 people there. And I literally take my wife as my security blanket because, you know, I enjoy public speaking. I like being on stage as the one guy in front because that's my thing, right? You know, I can pull on you mentioned earlier, James, that sort of, you know, you pull on the armor or the costume, and that works for me. But to actually be in the crowd mingling, I hate it. I can't stand it. So it's so very, very common.
It is. It's bizarre. Like, you know, you tread in the same path as me. And even to this day, right now, I still struggle with that. I'm trying to get better. You know, 2 weeks ago, we were speaking at a conference at the exhibition center in front of 450 people. Didn't bat an eyelid, didn't worry me one single bit.
Yep.
Come off the stage, and then, like you say, there's that network, and people want to come down and check. I don't know where to put my hands. I'm like, what do I do with my hands? What do I say? And I'm just trying to find a corner to go and hide. I still battle with that. And the more I'm doing, you know, a lot more public speaking, a lot more events and things, that's great, that side of it. But like you said, the networking side of it, I still struggle with. And I think it comes down to that judgment of, like you said, when you're on a stage, people are looking at you for that purpose. You're speaking about this topic. Awesome. When I'm just being me talking about just general, then all of a sudden, now the guard's down. Yeah, people may be able to see the real me.
Is that
something else you want to see?
Yep. Yep. And look, it's different for different people. Something I wanted to ask James is, because I think there's a lot of fantastic work being done by a lot of organisations. I'm noticing there's a lot of talk about suicide and suicide prevention and suicide stats. And while that is that's sort of the end game that we absolutely need to be doing as much as we possibly can as a community, as an industry, to protect people, I guess, from that and catch them so that we can turn them. But before that, there's a whole, I think, a much bigger opportunity to impact people. And I feel like the discussion around suicide sometimes distracts the conversation from mental health and what it is, you know, and even our little conversation here about anxiety and you know, being at a networking group. The number of tradies I know that won't go to networking because it freaks them out. To me, that is a sign that there is something there that has an opportunity to be talked about and not allowed to turn into something greater. What's your take on that, mate?
Absolutely, 100% on the money. So we've put together our sort of, I suppose, 4 to 5 year strategy for our organization now. Now we started with the suicide prevention, partnered up with Mates in Construction. Obviously, I know that you've had Justin on and a bit about them. We sort of piloted the Mates in Energy for the energy industry. So we've started with the suicide prevention, but what is very passionate for me is exactly what you say. It's that broader understanding. We want to prevent people to get to that point, absolutely 100%. We don't just want to be stood at that gate trying to stop people when they're there, because that's not the easiest place to be helping people.
No.
And we're very under-resourced in that space. So we need to move outwards, I suppose. So, you know, what we've developed some stuff at work and I'm doing externally is just trying to create just high level to begin with. You don't need to go right into, I do mental health first aid courses. I'm a facilitator for that. That's an awesome course, but it's 2 days. And sometimes people don't have 2 days, and it is a great investment, but I get that some people can't invest that. So how do we shorten that down just so that people have just a general awareness of what mental illness looks like and what are some effective interventions, where you can go, how you recognize it, when you recognize it, what can you do about it? So I'm sort of building some of that stuff. But then more broader than that, moving outside from there, before we even get there, how do we keep the people who are well at the moment, how do we keep them well?
How do we
our lives to keep us in a good spot and recognize when we are compromising those things that keep us well, why are we compromising it and where that could lead to? So, obviously I don't need to harp on too long. There's a lot of research around it, but, things like mindfulness, exercise, your nutrition, your food and sleep. Four key pillars there. Really, I talk about non-negotiable things that you shouldn't negotiate on those. And often when life gets busy, when life gets hectic, we sacrifice those things. And they're the very things that are core to keep us well. So I'm very passionate about the well-being side of things before we get to the pointy end of the stick.
Because those things really, we talk about these big, strong men. Those things like sleep and nutrition and mindfulness keep us as big, strong men. So that we can deal with life's challenges. And I don't mean to be sexist or genderist. I don't know what the 2019 term for that is these
Take
days.
Your pick.
But blokes have this bloody ridiculous hard exterior shell that we create, and inside can be, melted marshmallow just complete turmoil. And it's a paradigm that guys like you, James, and so many are working so hard to maybe not change it, because I don't think that will ever change, but I think it's allowing it to be seen as common and almost normal that you would feel like, you know, a thick shake inside despite the hard exterior.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, it's hard to influence that because I know, you know, it's been a little while since I've been on a construction site, in a few years now, but if I would have turned up with a salad, Mohammed, whereas now, that's what I eat healthy food, yes. You know, but if I would have turned up, you know, with health, like a lunchbox with all healthy stuff, and I'm like, I'm bolted, you know, they would have just been on me. If I said, I'm just going to whip off to the van for, you know, 20 minutes, just do a bit of meditation. Oh, geez. Like, you just wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to change is why not? This is good. This is what prevents, you know, it's build those things in. They are a preventative lock for the risk factors for developing mental illnesses. You know, if we can build some of this stuff in.
It seems, for want of a better term, crazy to me that we point the finger at our businesses or at the economy or at, you know, money stress or our marriages or our kids or whatever it is as the reason why we're stressed and angry and burned out, when sometimes it can be as simple as those things that you said. And I want to get some tips from you, James, for people listening that maybe have gone, geez, that sounds a bit like what I've been experiencing lately. It can be as simple as changing what you stick in your pie hole, changing how you sleep and your sleep habits and screen time and that sort of stuff. And, you know, getting a bit of that mindfulness, whatever that looks like for the individual, can actually reduce the impact of those external factors so incredibly. And yet it's not, I still don't feel like it's being talked about enough.
No, it's not. And that's why, like I said, that's where my passion lies at the moment. As much as I want to prevent suicide, as much as I want to help with mental illness, I don't like immersing myself in that day in, day out, because it's not healthy for me either.
Yeah.
To be in that world day in, day out. So I have to fill my cup elsewhere. And that's where I was talking about well-being sort of stuff. So those four key pillars that I talk about there, to help me, I call it MENS, so MENS, so mindfulness, exercise, nutrition, sleep. That's what I call it, you know. And I mentioned it to my teenage daughter, and she's like, you know, that's awesome. Really like the sound of that, but, you know, MENS is a bit, you know, doesn't work for me. You know, what do you think? You know, you call it what you want, but those are the sort of key elements. You said, what about if I work on those four things? Now it's women's. Awesome.
I love it.
I was wondering how you're going to do that, mate.
That's very well done.
It's cross-gender, and I have to give her credit for that every time I mention it. But those are the four key elements. And like I say, you don't need to go crazy, you know. Like, so mindfulness, I wouldn't have even dreamt of it, you know, a few years ago, because I thought it was for weirdos and hippies, you know. It's apparently. But, you know, it can be as simple as I've got 5 minutes, I'm feeling a little bit stressed. Like you're saying, you know, you get that stress. Okay, what can I do? I go on YouTube and I can type in 5 minute mindfulness. And it just tells me even what to do, breathe in, breathe out. But we often say I'm too busy for that. Well, who hasn't got 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Same with exercise. All right, you haven't got time to go to the gym. I've started, you know, just going for a walk. So I go for a walk every day. I go to the gym every day, but also go for a walk as well. So I know if I didn't get time to get to the gym, at least I've had a walk. And it can be as simple as that. And with the nutrition stuff, or you haven't got to go, oh, it's too hard to get on these crash diet, whatever. You don't need to be a diet. It's just slight changes in your lifestyle. Or even as simple as not skipping meals. Just as simple as having your meals and not, I'll eat on the run, you know, just going, well, make sure I have my lunch and my dinner and my breakfast.
Yep.
And the same with sleep, you know, we all go through times where we don't sleep real well. But if you have a pattern, I'll go to bed at the same time every night.
Yes.
Might not get to sleep, but it's all about that circadian rhythm, they call it, you know, but that's when the chemicals are released in your brain. And if you keep upsetting that, you're not helping things. So it can be real simple to build those things into your life. And they do have a massive, massive impact.
James, can we talk a little bit more about mindfulness? Because I think it still has that big stigma we were talking about. And yet mindfulness is something that we actually all practice on a day-to-day basis without even being aware that we're doing it or we're allowing ourselves to get distracted in those moments. So my husband has a lot of struggles with his mental health, and we've done a lot of work on his mindfulness. And I explained to him at one point, and it finally really triggered for him and he understood it. When he's at work and he's thinking about only what he's doing at work, he's not thinking about the kids at home, he's not thinking about the bills to pay, he's not thinking about the dog to walk or whatever other pressure he has in his life. For him, that's his form of mindfulness, because it's that time in his day where he's just narrowed in on the one thing and all those other distractions aren't there. So can you give us some other examples of where we're actually being mindful in a day, we just don't realize that we have that opportunity?
Perfect. And you're exactly on the money there. I'll share a little bit more of how I came up with the mindfulness stuff. So for me, when I was off work and I wasn't, you know, I was in a really bad spot, for one day, for some unknown reason, I don't know why even to this day, but I thought, I want to do a picture. Now, look, I've never really been into art or done art or anything like that. And I did. I did this picture. And what I found was when I was immersed in that, I wasn't thinking about anything else. And art was a real big part of my recovery journey. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the pictures I did back in the day weren't real that flash. They were just getting emotions out. But what I found was I could lose a couple of hours, not really remember what I was doing. I was mm-hmm. just getting emotions on the paper. And as time's progressed, now I've developed, well, mindfulness for me can be different things at different times of the day, on different day. It's like you say, it's that when you're just in the moment. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I might just listen to music. Sometimes I might play music, you know, a guitar or something. Sometimes it's art. Sometimes it's when you're doing a job. I've got a task to do, whatever it may be, you know, some menial job or something, but I'm really going to focus on doing it. And it can be, people think you've got to go and sit under some tree and burn incense sticks, and it's not that.
No.
It's just giving your brain just time to focus on one thing and not letting it away with those things. Mm. So that's why I try to promote that. Find what it is for you, or find a bunch of things what it is for you, and use it. Try and build it into your life because it's really important. It doesn't necessarily mean you've got to go off and meditate. It can be, or listen to some music. Mm. It can be go for a ride on a motorbike, or drive my car, or sit at the beach, or I do a whole bunch of things depending where I'm at that moment in time. But it's all mindfulness.
Yes. And it's just being able to unpack that a little bit gives us an opportunity to make, particularly men who are traditionally a little shyer of these things, make them understand that there is room and space in your day, many times during your day, to practice mindfulness. Mm. And when we can block out those distractions, and we can block out that negative voice that we all have, that when we're unwell talks a whole bunch more than when we're very well, we give our brain that bit of space and time and pause and reset that does keep us healthy.
Mm. It's just drawing breath.
It's no different to, you know, like physical side of things. You know, if you say you go to the gym and you're doing some weights or whatever, well, you've got to put the weight down and have a rest between sets. Whatever you're doing, your brain's the same. You've got to give it a bit of a break. You can't just keep continually working it and expect it to function at a high, you know, level of performance. Mm. It's no different to your body. But you know, you wouldn't run a marathon, cross the line, have a little sip of water, and run another one. But we expect from our brain, you know, we expect that. We expect to just keep continually solving problems, doing things, thinking about things, and not giving it a break.
Mm. Yeah,
and we probably need to build that in to make sure we look after ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We need to be teaching this at schools.
Yeah.
You know, I've got three teenagers. They're not learning this at school. And I know it's my job as a mum to teach them that, but how much better would it be for our children, the next generation, if they were learning at school rather than us not knowing until we're adults? Yeah. And for many, it's far too late.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I've heard of some schools building some of this stuff in, and look, again, outside of work, I work on a number of projects and different groups and stuff. So I'm actually working with a group in the Brisbane North area at the moment, working on some stuff. And I'm looking after the workplace side of things from an external point of view. But I want to look at the school stuff as well.
Mm. Yeah.
To what we can do differently in schools, because otherwise we just continually keep churning out generation after generation and fixing the problem when we've got a problem, rather than addressing how do we build in mindfulness in schools, understand well-being stuff. And it's really, you know, I've got two teenagers very close to my heart as well. Mm. You know, that we talk about this openly, that's cool, but do all their friends, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
So
yep.
Wouldn't it be good if that was just common knowledge?
Mm.
Yeah. It's been interesting. So my daughter's been diagnosed with autism a number of years ago, and she turns 8 in a week and a half. And to help her with her anxiety as part of being, you know, high-functioning autistic, she's been taught meditation and mindfulness from a kid's perspective. And it's been really interesting as a parent teaching a child, you know, a 4-year-old, a 5-year-old, how to just stop and do some breathing to calm themselves down. And now she does it herself. It's just natural when she feels anxious or worried or, you know, if her pet lamb is sick and she's feeling sad about it, she literally takes herself off and goes and does some breathing and looks at a tree and comes back and she's like, I'm okay now. And it's just, it's natural for her. And it's like, imagine if, like you guys are saying, you know, if we built that into just the kit bag of skills that we have as humans, you know, what would society look like? What would social media look like? You know, it'd be very different, I suspect.
Oh, I think that's a fantastic story, mate. And yeah, thanks for sharing that because, like you say, it's when you can actually see the benefits from it, from that point of view, I think it's awesome.
Mm.
You know, because otherwise what we see, you know, particularly with teenagers, they go through all of emotions and hormones and whatever. And if they don't know how to address that stuff, we see that come out, you know, like I see it at home. I've got a teenage boy, you know, and awesome fella. But, you know, he has these surges of adrenaline or whatever. Now, you know, he finds ways of coping with that now, which is cool because we talk about it. But imagine if it was built in that, okay, this is what's going on. You know, and give them a bit more understanding.
Yeah. Yep.
When you get a bunch of them together, all out and about, you know.
Yeah.
It's hectic.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine them going, I'm going to go and do some breathing. We're not at that point.
Well, maybe.
Especially for teenage boys.
But maybe part of it is making it cool, you know. I look at what some of the, you know, particularly in the CrossFit world. I don't know if you're familiar with Seal Fit, James, but you know, there's Navy SEALs teaching what they call box breathing, and it's dead set. It's controlled breathing. It's about calming the body and the mind and using that for performance. I mean, if we make it cool, then it's more likely to be picked up, particularly by the males, because you know, we tend to need to look good to our mates.
yeah, you're right. Yeah, that's where it needs to come from, that angle and that lens. If it's not seen as cool, then people will start taking a, you know, mick out of you or whatever, and then that raises the anxiety and just in
circle. Yep. We need to get a hashtag going for, like, you know, breathe like a tradie or something.
You and your hashtags.
I'm trying to be cool. I wanted to get some action steps. I guess, you know, for listeners, whether it's husbands, wives, you know, doesn't matter. What are some actions that people can take, James, whether they're identifying with what we're talking about or they're thinking, geez, I wonder if my mate's, you know, maybe going through some stuff like this. Like, what are some broader action steps that people can take, James?
Yeah, so for me, I always sort of advocate for Beyond Blue. If you go on their website, you know, whether you're going through some stuff yourself, whether you're worried about a friend or a loved one or whatever it may be, there's a whole bunch of really, really good information on there that you can actually learn what to look for, what to actually do, where to go. They've got a 24-hour helpline. There's chat forums where you can go on there and talk to somebody if you don't actually want to talk face-to-face. There's videos on there. There's a whole array of stuff. So you can kind of educate yourself a little bit. And I needed to do that because I didn't understand it. And I found it helpful for me to actually go away in my own time and actually read a bit about this and go, oh, actually, yeah, that is happening to me. Here's some of the signs and symptoms. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe I do need to, you know, that was when before I went to the doctor, I went home and read a whole bunch of stuff. You can also use as a bunch of resources. I wouldn't just Google anything because there's some unreliable stuff like that. So look at your repertoire. The sources, you know, Beyond Blues and your Black Dogs and those sort of organizations.
Yep.
But if you just need to talk to somebody, you know, like Lifeline, there's Men's Line, it's Beyond Blue, there's there's numbers out there you can call, and you don't need to be at crisis point when you give them a call. Mm. Just give them a ring, and Lifeline have got a text line as well. I think that's open from 6 till midnight. If you just, I've been there myself, you just can't physically face talking to somebody.
Yeah.
You can just text somebody, and they'll be able to talk to you. But do something is better than doing nothing. And that's from a lived experience perspective,
yeah.
You know, that they're ignoring it, or the I'll just get through it, I'll toughen up and man up, almost didn't, you know, work out real good for me. And thankfully I got through it. But now, like I say, if there's one little thing I'd say to take away is just go and read up on some stuff and educate yourself. And Beyond Blue's website is a good starting point. It's an awesome place.
Mm. Yeah, it's like equip yourself for life by just learning some of those basic skills.
Mm. James, I just wanted to touch on one more thing just quickly. A lot of men in particular have a real fear around talking and starting to express. I guess I just wanted to get your take on that and how to begin that conversation when you are in a not so great place.
Yeah, I suppose, well, you need to know who you can talk to first, you know, so you're going to know your close friends. And if there's nobody you can talk to there, then reach out to those helplines. But for me, that biggest step is the hardest step. And even from time to time now, and I'm not saying I've got the world sewn up, so you just can't look at me like I'm a guru, but even now, sometimes I struggle with things and I think I'll just give Lifeline or Beyond Blue a call. And I struggle to pick up the phone because I think in my own head, well, you're like the mental health guy now, you know, you're doing all this stuff. That's weak of you to pick up the phone, and I go back to those old way, and that's really, I still from time to time find that hard. So it's about then you sort of build in some stuff. I've got mates and stuff I can call on, who good mates, you know, who I can just say, look, you don't need to fix anything, you don't need to do anything for me, but this is where I'm at now. Can you just listen to me? Can we just have a chat? You know, and that's what you can use the lines for as well. But like I said, it's not easy, and I'm not saying it is. So as far as that, you know, what you were saying there, I'd just say fine. You know, you're going to have friends you can talk to. And if you don't, there's always phone numbers you can give a ring and just talk to somebody. And worst case scenario, you just, hey, I'll go straight to the doctors or I'll go straight to A&E, wherever I need to go. But you need to go and talk to somebody. That's the key. You know, because there is help out there. There is pathways to recovery. And with the right tools and skills, you will get through it. You need help.
If I could just add into that, just based on my own experience, sometimes it's okay just to say, I'm in a bad place. And when it really won't matter who you're talking to, whoever it is that you're able to trust with that information, whether it be the person on the end of the phone, the doctor, your mate, your husband or your wife, will have enough tools to get you some help. And it's okay just to, if you can't talk, it's okay to say, I'm just in a bad place, I need some help. Just take that first step.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't need to have the full plan and go, okay, so then what's going to happen and then what's going to happen? And that can be hard when you are in a bad place. But
of course.
I guess it's just that tiny little opening that will allow change to happen. So, and that doesn't have to be scary or confronting. So,
I just bring it back to the physical side of things. You know, that's what helps me get through it. Because I think if I'd broke my ankle, I'm not going to go, well, it'll be, I'll walk it off, because I'm not going to, So if I'm in a bad spot, you know, if I break my ankle, I'm going to have to go and get that seen to. Otherwise, it's not going to be good for the rest of my life. And it's no different to if I'm not in a good spot in my head, well, I'm going to need to go somewhere just for a bit of support, a bit of help to get me through this, you know.
That's right.
So that kind of helped me when I bring those similarities in.
Well, mate, it's been fantastic to chat to you. I know we've been through a bit of a process to get to today, so it's great to have you on the show, mate. I suppose, and you've mentioned Beyond Blue and a lot of organisations. Is there somewhere people can go and check you out, or perhaps the work you're doing, or is there a website you'd like to share, or a social handle?
I'm on LinkedIn, so that's probably where most of my stuff gets put.
Yep.
So you can find me on there. And yeah, that's kind of where you'll see most of my journey and most of the stuff that I do. And if you do want to reach out and talk to me, by all means, drop me a message on that.
Great. And we'll put all the links to Beyond Blue and all those fantastic organisations in the show notes. Mate, I just want to say thank you again. Really thanks, grateful James. For your time.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks for having me. It's been good. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Well, I really enjoyed that episode. I hope that you did too.
I did.
If that's brought anything up for you, though, we thought we'd close with the numbers that we referenced a few times there. The number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. That's a 24-hour number. You can call any time. They do have a text line, so if you just can't bring yourself to talk to somebody on the phone, you can text. It's 0477 13 1114. 0477 13 11 14. I believe that's open just late at night rather than during the day, so you might need to...
6 till midnight or something. Yeah. So usually sitting on the couch, tearing the hair out, wondering what the hell.
That's right. Or you've opened that bottle of Jim Beam and you're not sure where you want to go from there. Give them a text at least. Please do something. And then finally, Beyond Blue, 1300 22 46 36. 1300 22 46 36. Please, guys and girls.
Yeah.
Guys in general. I meant that as a collective noun.
Peeps. Just say peeps. And then please, they sound peeps. Really cool, too.
Oh, hip. I can't be hip. My kids are embarrassed when I'm hip.
You're too old to be hip.
I am. But please, please reach out. Just begin talking. If you're at that critical point, please have a conversation with someone, whether it be in person or via text. Let's start. Don't forget, Woz and I are always here for you as well. We are currently helping a couple of members from our Tradies and Business Facebook group that are having a bit of a hard time. Sometimes it helps to not necessarily know the person that you're talking to, just to have, it's not quite anonymous in this case, but a conversation with someone that you know that can help you, but you don't necessarily have to tell us everything. We don't need to know. We're just here to help.
Yeah. And for anybody listening that has suspicions or concerns about someone else, and you know, we're not talking suicide specifically, but just if you feel like someone's not right, not okay, not themselves, go and ask them.
Yeah, please.
Say, hey, are you okay? Like, seriously, tell me, dude, are you okay? And just start that conversation. So thanks again for listening. Big shout out to everybody in our group for supporting each other, Tradies in Business on Facebook. You know, we've got more than 1,000 tradies in there, and it's always really comforting to see that level of support. So we just want to spread that that same support to everybody out there in podcast land. So until next episode, hooroo.
Bye.
You've been listening to the Tradies in Business podcast with Warwick Bidwell and Nicole Cox. Find out more about today's guest, tools for your trade business, and other cool stuff at tradiesandbusiness.com.au.